Today is Saturday, February 25th, 2023. This is part 5 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Richard Strange. Richard spells his last name S-T-R-A-N-G-E. Good morning, Richard. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
So far, so good. Richard, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Richard, you mentioned a wonderful story about Rose Mofford last time and your 10-year plan to become a photographer. When did you kind of tie up or retire, I guess, from ADOT and then head off into photography?
Let's start this with laughing between ourselves. It only took us a half an hour to get this interview off the ground this time.
That's right.
Basically, in 1998, a couple of major things had happened. I had my knees replaced.
Oh.
And I was able to start walking a little bit better. And then I had got to the point where in this 10-year plan that I had developed, I pretty much had met all of the goals and objectives in about 7 to 8 years of that 10-year plan. So I sat there and looked at what I could do to see about going on and retiring and being a real photographer. And I had looked at an option of buying back 2.5 years of state service with the state of Indiana, and in doing that, that would count towards my years of service in Arizona.
Oh.
So that cost me a few thousand dollars, but I figured that what that would do in increasing my retirement would be paid for in about 5 years' time.
Okay.
So I decided to buy that time back and go on retire at 51 years old from the state, and I was able to do so with a full retirement.
Wow.
And immediately, walking out the door, I got hired by HDR Engineering to do marketing. And I worked for HDR Engineering for about 2.5 years. The last part of it, though, I was working just part-time. And the whole idea was to get my house paid for so that becoming a photographer with less income would be okay and I'd be able to live. And so knowing that it would be probably 15 years later before I would get Social Security, which will be the last raise that I would get in my life.
Right.
So I after HDR Engineering, I did some part-time work for a couple of years as well for a drainage sub-consultant, helping out some friends, doing marketing for them, and then eventually cut the cord altogether and just went forth with my retirement income and my income as a photographer.
Okay.
And one of the things that I found that I could do as a photographer, I actually had started when I was working for HDR Engineering. I was able to go up in helicopters and take aerial photography of project sites, and then in Photoshop build a photograph out of parts of other projects of what a finished project somewhere would look like. And I had about a 50% win rate, which is pretty extraordinary, where these photo simulations were used. And interestingly, about these photo simulations, the guy who wanted these the most seemed to be Jerry Cannon.
Oh, really? Hang on a second, Richard. Photoshop would have come out about that night, that time. This is kind of cutting-edge stuff you were working with.
Well, that's right. The first versions of Photoshop that I was using was the Photoshop 4 and the Photoshop 5. when they got to Photoshop 6 and Photoshop 7, it got really, really difficult. I preferred using the earlier versions of Photoshop because that these were extremely large files, and they would have sometimes 30 or 40 or 50 different layers in them.
Wow.
And when they got to the later versions, they started adding other features in there, like video features, and then the ability to remember all of your changes. I think it was for 25 steps backwards.
Wow.
And when you've got files that were somewhere between 300 and 500 megabytes and several layers, and they started remembering all of your changes back 25 steps ago, that would take up so much memory, it would slow the programs down significantly.
Oh, interesting.
Every time you wanted to close them or open them up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found it was easier to go back and use the earlier versions rather than to use the updated versions.
Okay. Cool.
What do you think about that?
I think that's pretty neat because, you know, it's a tool we still use quite a bit here in the house, and you were on that thing early on.
Yes, I was. And so I became pretty much of an expert, only I was very limited to the kinds of things that I did with it because they were targeted towards a specific audience and some very specific features, but I was very good at it. And the other thing that I really liked about the early versions of Photoshop was the drop-down menus were very much intuitively obvious as far as finding new tools. When you'd go to the heading of the drop-down menu, it was pretty obvious what you were going to find in there.
Hmm.
When they started adding other things in there, many of those features got moved around to where it took me a lot of time sometimes to find out, okay, where are the features I'm used to using at now?
Hmm. Yeah.
So a lot of times I felt they didn't really make this better, they just made it different.
Yeah, okay. That's true for a lot of that stuff.
Back to Jerry Cannon.
Yes.
One of the adventures that I had with Jerry Cannon was the 4th Street Railroad underpass in Tucson. It was a historic district, a historic bridge, and there was a historic railroad station on down the tracks from it. And this was a really important project to the city of Tucson, because they wanted to improve the safety and get trolley cars and automobiles both underneath this bridge. And the whole idea of it originally, I believe, was to be able to use one of the lanes for traffic only and one of the lanes for either trolley cars or traffic. And we did these photo simulations where there was like an old hotel or rooming house or something on one corner of this bridge, and I was able to take some photographs towards Tucson that showed where the bridge location was, the old railroad train station off behind it, and then a couple of the downtown buildings in the distance.
Okay.
And so this was a perfect vantage point for looking at what the various architectural features and options on this bridge could be.
Okay.
So that the city and the public could determine what they wanted done. And one of the things about this process was there were a whole bunch of different options that they wanted to show, which included even building noise walls.
Oh, wow.
Across this bridge to help block out the noise of the trains to the local neighborhoods. They wanted to build a park on one corner as well. And in doing these noise walls, one of the interesting things is, like, they wanted to build noise walls, then they wanted to put a whole series of different shapes of openings in the noise wall so that people using the multi-use paths that were built across the bridge could see through them. Yet when you start putting openings in a big, huge noise wall, you kind of are defeating
the purpose.
The purpose of the noise wall.
Oh, my gosh.
And some of these things became, I want to say, almost contentious items between Jerry and the city of Tucson, because sometimes there were things that they wanted that would defeat the purpose of why they were doing it. And so Jerry often had to walk a very thin line, kind of like a tightrope, on doing what they were asking for politically as opposed to what was feasible in doing a project of this magnitude. But I think that when all was said and done, he was able, with all of these graphics, to make everybody happy. And it also became then one of my hallmark processes, because Jerry was the person that probably used me the most, but there were several engineering companies that would ask me to do these photo simulations for them, either to do their marketing to try to win projects or to use in their public information processes. And so as a new photography business, this was something that me and only me, or should I say I, was able to do, because I had both the engineering background,
right,
and the photographic knowledge and the Photoshop capabilities to marry all of this into a process that made me a significant amount of money on occasion.
And the artistic talent to blend it all together.
Well, that's true. You know, I never really considered that, but that's true.
Yeah. No, it seems like a lot of people can, you know, they got the Photoshop skills and they got the camera skills, but to have the artistic vision, you know.
Yeah.
In this oral history series, that's, I think, of you. So
when you talk about those artistic skills, I have to say there were even some kinds of things that I would do that, like, for instance, when you really wanted to sell one of those concepts, put trees in it that had fruit, or Palo Verdes that had some bloom coming, or the jackalopes that had the purple blooms. You could add some minor touches to something to dress it up artistically, and people really didn't realize what you were doing.
Nice.
That almost sounds dishonest, doesn't it?
You know, it does, but what people are trying to get is a vision of what is this going to look like when it's done. And that's where I think an artist can step in and say, you know, I can probably draw that out or concept that out and show you.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's being disingenuous or in any way.
The ones with the bridges are the ones that I always liked the most.
And that makes perfect sense, given your history of
there was a railroad underpass somewhere up in Tucson. I can't remember exactly what it was, but there was a railroad bridge up in Tucson that I did for Jerry that they were trying to sell to.
Was that Kino? Was that the Kino Parkway Bridge? Maybe.
Oh, no. I'm sorry, in Flagstaff.
Oh, in Flagstaff.
Yeah.
Oh, the Fourth Street Overpass, maybe. Here.
That might have been it. I don't recall the name. I'd have to look further into my.
It works well. It's working well today.
the interesting thing is like Jerry had. There was a bridge there. There was one in Sholo. I think the one in Sholo never did get built, but it was one of my favorite ones as far as the options that he was wanting to show. It had all stone fascia on the bridge and was just beautiful what he wanted to do, but they never did end up being able to come up with the funding to do it.
How long were you working in that capacity, doing concept planning, drawings, photographs using Photoshop.
I was doing these as a part of my photography business for probably maybe 10 to 12 years.
Okay.
There came a point in time that the funding at the Department of Transportation got really, really tight, and so there wasn't a whole lot of new projects going out, and so the companies weren't making as much money, so there wasn't as much money to use in marketing. So by probably 2012, 2014, was probably about the end of this type of work that I was doing.
Okay. And for your own personal photography, where did you take that? Did you take that back to Grand Canyon at all?
During those years, when I was really interested in the Grand Canyon photography, was during the years when I was doing backpacking.
Ah, right.
And you know, most of my backpacking, we had mentioned the backpacking before, and one of the things that I didn't mention was a lot of the backpacking I did was in the superstitions. And I've looked back historically into my files, and most of the backpacks that I took, I didn't even take cameras. And I think it's because the weight was so sensitive there,
yeah.
And I was already having trouble with both my back and my knees.
Mm.
And so when I got to where I had the knee replacements, I still had the back issues. And when I kind of made a conscious decision in the early 2000s that what I needed to do was, instead of concentrating as much around Arizona, since I did have a pretty good photographic library in Arizona, I needed to venture out farther and take longer trips in vehicles instead of the trips in Arizona.
Oh.
Now that I was retired, I could take longer and more productive trips. And so sometimes I would go off for 6 and 8 weeks at a time. And here later, you know, no more than 5 and 6 years ago, a couple of those trips turned into 3-month trips.
Oh, wow.
And so my photography in the Grand Canyon, the interesting thing is I still would like to run up there once or twice a year, but not as often and for not as long. And I didn't always stay around for the good light
right.
Like I used to.
Got it.
But I still like going, and oftentimes on my trips to up through Utah, when I'd go up I-40, I oftentimes couldn't hesitate to, you know, go on up 180 and drive along the Grand Canyon. Even if I wasn't going to stop to take pictures, I'd pull off on a couple of those viewpoints and just sat there for a few minutes just looking.
Nice.
I mean, I actually loved this place more than I think I could describe.
Hmm.
And yet all of the trips that I was going by there weren't necessarily for photography anymore.
Cool. What were you...
I think
yeah.
Those of you who spend a lot of time up there understand it.
Yeah.
Kind of like going out and looking at your mountain in Flagstaff. You know, you don't always go out there and look at the mountain to take pictures. You just look at it because it's there.
Right. Right. Yeah. No. Every now and then, you know, somebody says, "Look at the mountain," and I look up and, oh my gosh, it's a sunset light, and it's all golden and covered in snow, and You're like, oh my.
I would do the same thing driving along that road on the edge of Lake Powell and going up through Utah. Sometimes I used to like to, if I was going up to the north, like if I were going to Yellowstone or the Tetons, it wouldn't be unlike me to drive up and go along the east rim of the Grand Canyon, drive on over and take a trip over and drive past Lake Powell, go up into Utah, drive the Mount Carmel Road through Zion over to Interstate 15, go up to Cedar City, and then head on the road that goes up past Cedar Breaks and on back over to 89, go over, drive into Fairyland and take a quick look at Bryce, and then go on up, I think that's Highway 12, up to someplace like Capitol Reef, and just look at a lot of those places. And I would do that sometimes and not take a single picture.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's kind of like, I don't make pictures like other photographers. I see pictures. And for me to see something that is artistic and draws me in, I have to be in a mood. And sometimes I'm just driving by those places because they're comfortable and I like being there. And sometimes I just don't have the desire or the feel to do photography.
Okay. That makes sense.
Doesn't make any sense, does it?
Well, it does as an artist.
Well, and I think that's why, you know, I was always an artist first before I was a photographer. And, you know, in the early 1900s, and I'm going to backtrack a little bit here on you.
Okay.
The state of Arizona roadside development was working on rebuilding all of the rest areas in the state of Arizona. And they approached me about using my photography to highlight all of the areas in Arizona that they wanted people to stop at. And a consultant working on a project lost a notebook that had 1,100 of my best images.
Wow.
1,100 of the heart of my photographs up through that time were lost. And I had some prints of them, and then
you were not shooting digital at the time. These were prints.
I was shooting transparencies.
And you had given this guy this binder of your photos.
Of my original slides, yes.
Holy cow.
And that was devastating to me at the time because that was right at the beginning of my 10-year plan.
Wow.
And it basically cut the heart out of my photographic library because my best stuff from all around the state now was gone. Now, I'm going to estimate maybe 10% of them I had in-camera dupes, and I had in many of them other good shots, but they were not my favorites and not my best. And one of the things that happened at that point in time was that in filing a lawsuit against the state of Arizona, the attorneys brought in as their expert witness this lady who was the photo editor at National Geographic. And before they brought her in for the valuation of them, they had me seek out, a couple of the Arizona highway photographers to go over my material since I was very young and hadn't had a lot published as of that time to see, well, just how good is this stuff that was lost. And probably one of the things that made the biggest impression on me as a young photographer was meeting Dick Dietrich. And Dietrich was slowly going through these pages of transparencies, maybe a half a dozen of them, and maybe about 20 or 30 prints that I had. And he was very carefully looking through all this stuff. And a couple of times I asked him, well, so what do you think? He said, I'm not finished. And, you know, and I'm sitting there impatiently waiting for this old guy to get through looking at these. And then he finally puts everything down and he looks at me and he says, you know, Richard, I was always a photographer, but you aren't a photographer. You're an artist.
Wow.
That's what Dick Dietrich said to me.
Cool.
And it kind of floored me, because it kind of set my attitude towards what I was doing, because, you know, he was the best. And he's telling me that he's just a photographer, but I'm an artist. And you know, he was a guy who I was using his photography as well as some of these other old people in Arizona highways to help me learn what it was that I was to look for.
Hmm.
And then he told me, he says, you know, I can't help you too much with the valuation here. That's kind of beyond me. But he says, let me call somebody. And he gets on the phone and he calls up Jerry Jacka. And he asked Jerry Jacka if he would talk with me about these and if he would look at my photography.
How do you spell Jerry's last name?
Jacka, J-A-C-K-A.
Thank you.
He was another one of the well-known and most published photographers in Arizona Highways at
right.
the time.
Right. It's going to say it's Arizona Highways.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I went over to his house. Boy, did he have an impressive house.
Mm.
He was up, I think, off at Dunlap in North Phoenix in one of these big yards full of grass where you would expect to have horses and things.
Hmm.
But he was also very kind to me initially, and then he turned stern. And he told me, he says to me, look, the value for this stuff, no matter whether it would ever be published or not, but because of the potential, it's all of the same caliber and quality as what Dick is talking about, where you should not settle for anything less than $1,500 per transparency.
Whoa.
And he said, that's what this stuff is worth on the market. And he said, it has taken us a long time to get values established when people damage or lose our work.
Hmm.
He says, because one of the facts of life as a photographer is people are going to leave some of your material out. They're going to spill things on them. They're
right.
going to scratch them. And you have the potential of every one of these things not being published just once, but 10 or 15 or 20 times
oh, interesting.
During the life of your career.
Right.
And so if somebody damages something, it has value because that is income loss.
Hmm.
And he is telling me about, you know, values in other magazines other than Arizona Highways where you may get $400, $600, or $800 for a single use of something. And so then the lady from National Geographic, then when she came in and valued all that material, she valued it at $1.8 million, which to me was just like, gee, many Christmas, how can that be? And when all was said and done, the lawyer screwed up, and I got very little when all was said and done, but it was quite an education to go through this process. And that legal process took nearly a decade.
Wow.
And when it was all said and done, I was glad it was over. But this led to something else that happened after I had retired from ADOT and let them use all those images. And by the way, those are still my images that you see on those panels in the rest areas. All 31 of them.
Cool.
But now they're all fading, and,
yeah.
and they need to redo them. But in the early 2000s, I had taken a photograph of the Hale-Bopp comet in 1997 that took me quite a number of trips, maybe six of them, out into the deserts to figure out how to do it. And I finally figured out I needed to use 400 ASA transparencies and push them two full stops, which made them 600 ASA to be able to take a nighttime photograph like that where the Hale-Bopp comet would register. It's a lot easier doing that stuff with digital photography than it was on transparencies. But to backtrack to what Jerry Jacka was telling me, there was one of those images of the Hale-Bopp comet that I lit up a cactus during a 20-second time exposure. I lit up the cactus from the side with a flash.
Oh.
And that picture, through a stock agency, sold to the state of Arizona for $25,000.
Wow.
And it was used on the cover of their maps and their tourism book, and they probably used it in every magazine in the world to advertise tourism in the state of Arizona.
Hmm.
Now, here's why that was so important. It basically pointed out that, yeah, that $1,500 for transparency that Jerry Jacka was talking about was really important as far as the valuing of what your material is and what might be lost. But it also, $1,500 was not nearly as much as what that single image sold for.
Right.
And so even though not everything was going to sell enough times to get $1,500, there are a lot of your images that are going to sell for literally thousands of dollars. I had one of that sold to a national magazine of the little red lighthouse under the big gray bridge, which is the George Washington Bridge in New York City, that I sold through an internet service for, I think it was $1,500, $2,000, $2,500, something like that,
okay,
for a single image to be printed 4 inches by 6 inches in a magazine, because they couldn't find the perfect image to represent the children's story from many decades ago.
Ah.
And I happened to have the right image. and it's kind of like these values in some cases just can be astronomical.
Yeah.
And that $25,000 image, before I retired from ADOT, I was giving images not just to ADOT for the rest area project, but for the Arizona Office of Tourism. I had a friend over there, and I was lending slides to them.
They must have been very happy with that.
Oh, yeah. And, see, they were not yet a part of Arizona Highways Magazine.
Okay.
And one of the governors, I think it might have been Fife Symington, put the Office of Tourism under Arizona Highways so that they could use their photography rather than have them to buy it, and only to find out that, well, if you don't buy the rights for the photography from the photographers to begin with to do that, they still weren't able to use all that material that Arizona Highways had. And it was the Arizona Office of Tourism that paid $25,000 for that photograph of mine that I would have gladly given to them if they would have, instead of having everything all changed over the way they did under that specific governor, where they were no longer going out to some of us who were their friends, but having to purchase everything through services, through other purchasing type services, they paid an extraordinary amount for the same photography they could have gotten for free.
That's amazing.
What do you think of that,
Tom? Well, what I think of is it having artists on staff is rare. And when you don't have that and you need images, you have to pay for them.
Yeah. Well, you know, postcard companies are like that as well. I started out, postcards were one of the big deals for me about, okay, that's the way to get your name out to where a lot of people might see
it.
And I always enjoyed looking at all the postcards when I'd go into some place to try to see where the light was best and what some of the viewpoints are that I'd like to visit. And postcards were a big influence on my photography. Not that I wanted to copy people's styles, but because good photographers knew where the good places were at sunrises and sunsets. And so you could go out there and make all sorts of different artistic works if you already knew where you were going in advance. And you can go to a national park like Yellowstone, and if you don't know where to go, you can spend all day there and never get any good photographs.
Right.
But the thing is, the postcards for me then became a big deal because I'm looking at them and I'm thinking, okay, you know the places you want to go. Let's go out there and let's do it better. And postcards never did pay a lot of money, but oh boy, I remember before I ever had anything published in Arizona Highways, one of the things that helped with the postcards was this place. There was a man, Baker Hendricks, at M&H Advertising that wanted to start a postcard company. And he called this new company he was starting M&H, or Mostly Postcards. And they're still around today, and they have on their logo, when you turn them around, they have like a little prickly pear cactus on them that says Mostly Postcards. And the interesting thing about this was one of his early customers was Arizona Highways Magazine in that building over there west of Encanto Park. And before I was ever in that magazine, I used to walk in there to look and see how many of the postcards that they had in their rack were mine. And there was one time I remember going in there, and I'd never yet been in the magazine, and their whole objective was to be selling materials in there, all of their books and things that they were publishing. And the postcards they were buying, they weren't doing. They were buying them from a postcard company, and over half of the postcards that they had up there of Arizona were mine.
Wow.
Yet I'd never been in their magazine.
Huh.
And that always touched a sense of pride in me. And the same thing would happen up at the Babbitt stores when I would go up there Baker had developed an exclusive relationship for postcards and Grand Canyon books with the Babbitt stores. And so I had all kinds of stuff up there, including an Arizona book and a Grand Canyon book that we did. And when you'd go up there and visit, and you'd go in the Babbitt stores and you see your stuff all over the place in there on placemats and books and photographs. And we had a Grand Canyon calendar and an Arizona calendar. It was quite a boost to the ego to see all that stuff of yours
in a
store like that, especially that had the name Babbitt on it when he had been, I think, the favorite governor that I had worked for.
Oh, cool. Oh, that's fun. And when did you transition to digital?
I think I bought, 2003 rings a bell with me as to when I had my first digital camera. I know how to figure that out. Hold on here for a second. My first trip with my very first digital camera was to a trip to New England. And those pictures say October of 2003.
Okay.
So 2003, I bought my first digital camera, which was a Nikon 6-megapixel camera. And I still have a lot of great pictures from that, the only problem being they are only 6 megapixels. But I was not really sold on the digital photography because when on that trip, I had so many cameras with me. I had the digital camera. I had 35-millimeter cameras with film in them, and I had a 6x7 Pentax that was a film camera, and I was shooting digital and film both, and that became a real liability.
Huh.
But the thing that I found out, and this is actually true up even to this day, but up until a few years ago, the problem with the early digital cameras was that they had such a small dynamic range. That was the ability to register contrast. They could only register
right.
about, I don't know, 3 or 4 f-stops worth of contrast, where film, depending on the type of film, of course, was different. But the film, a good film could register 10 or 12 f-stops worth of contrast. And even today, it seems that they would increase that dynamic range about every 3 or 4 years along the way. And most people, even photographers, never did really understand the concept of the dynamic range. But they would increase the number of pixels and increase the dynamic range in increments to where you had to buy new cameras.
Oh, interesting.
And as they were increasing the number of pixels, it also required buying new camera equipment and new storage.
Right.
New computer equipment.
Yep.
And external storage and
yep.
going to clouds and all that stuff because the files kept getting larger and larger.
Yeah.
And if you shoot raw files, the files are enormous.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, I reached a point where I quit shooting raw files because the compression in the JPEGs became so good that
yeah.
I no longer had a need to shoot those really large files. And now I've got another problem. This last year I bought the 50 megapixel cameras, and I have both a Canon and a Nikon, and the files are so large that the loading and unloading and the processing of them, I just bought a new computer and it is extremely slow, and I'm thinking, you know what, my next cameras, I don't think that I need 50 megapixels any longer. I think I'm going to see about going down to something in the 30s because I don't need files this large. I'm not, nor do I have any inclination to do anything where the pictures are going to cover an entire wall.
Right.
And so I don't know that I need files this large.
Yeah, the whole thing becomes unwieldy.
Well, the time it takes to process, because see, here's the thing. What I hate about digital photography, and I actually have to use the word hate, because I absolutely hate going and having some good light somewhere, like at Bryce, and taking a picture that I've taken a dozen times before at Inspiration Point with some good early morning light, bringing it home and looking at a 4x5 that I took back in the 90s and having a digital picture that I have to manipulate in computer programs to bring it to where it reflects what I saw at the time and what I could get out of a 4x5 piece of film. I don't like having to do the post-processing rather than being able to get that image out of the camera as I see it. I don't like that.
Okay.
I don't know what you feel about that, but for me, it's like a lot of time that it takes in getting those photographs to where I want them.
You know, I'm not an artist, but I have heard this from my artist photography friends that making friends with digital has been a challenge.
Yes. And there's something else that comes along with that. You know, when you used to take pictures that would come out like really dramatic with film, you had to be there at the right time to be able to do that and know what you were doing.
Yes, and know what you're doing. Yes.
Huh?
And know what you are doing. That's the key. Be there at the right time. Well, I can be there, but to actually be smart enough to go, oh, let me get a camera and let me know how to use it with the settings to capture what I'm seeing. That's a lot to that.
And oftentimes, with the time of day, the difference between an average picture and a great picture was just a polarizer. But I'm surprised at how few people even know that, even today.
Right.
And when you can see, though, that what digital cameras do is they make someone like me even lazy, because I know I can go there when the light is an optimum, and I can take pictures and I can turn them into a great piece of artwork where they wouldn't have been like that without being manipulated in the digital world on the computer.
Right.
And then what happens is when you do have something that is a really great picture where you've done everything right at the right times, the first questions that are asked when you post them on the internet is, what did you do to manipulate this?
Right.
How did you do this?
Right.
And it's like, well, it's like that because that's what it looked like when I was there. And if you do put something up with an audience that you have at a different kind of place on Facebook, and you tell someone what you did to manipulate something, then they think everything that you're posting is manipulated.
Right, right.
So, you know, I am not a friend of digital photography. I'm kind of like one of these old-fashioned old bastards that really liked being able to do it in the camera, but I no longer shoot film, and I cannot get right out of the camera what I'm seeing. So there you go.
Yeah, you're not alone. You're not alone.
I have people argue with me about that, and I think, well, they must be better than I am if they're able to get their stuff out of the camera, and I'm not. But then when I look at what they do, I think, that explains it.
Well, that's the thing. If you've grown up with digital and its tools versus you've grown up with film and its tools, you know, they're different.
Well, and Tom, I told you before that I was an expert with Photoshop.
Hmm.
So it isn't like I can't manipulate these things.
Right. Right.
But I don't want to have to do that, and that's what my point is.
Hmm. Okay.
And then after that, I became retired, and I slowly but surely started doing less and less work, but I still try to do the trips. So I'm pretty much even retired as a photographer now.
But I'm assuming you take a camera with you just in case the stars all align and you're faced with a beautiful sunset or a beautiful sunrise and you go, I'm getting that.
Well, I go out specifically on photo trips, but there's another difference between me and other photographers. You know, I told you I can go on a trip for 6 or 8 weeks, and there will be several different days in that trip that I won't even take a single picture because I don't have the feeling, I'm not inspired.
Mm-hmm.
I can even be in an inspiring place, but because of the way I feel or something, I'll pass things by that on another trip I would have stopped and...
Hmm.
You know, and been looking for pictures. And sometimes I just drive through a place and enjoy it, and other times I drive through and I'm looking for pictures. I see when I'm driving, I describe myself often as a drive-by shooter because the older I've gotten, the more crippled up I am, and I can't hike, and sometimes I can't even walk out the viewpoints. I've got to be able to pull over. When I see something that is photo worthy, I have to be able to pull over and maybe slow roll on a shoulder or off the roadway and find the picture that speaks to me. And when you talk about taking a camera with me all the time, in the lectures that I did for the Sierra Club when they sent me to Alaska, one of the points I would make to people is that I don't carry my camera with me everywhere I go, because I never did want to be a slave to my camera.
Huh.
You want to be a slave to your art, but not to the camera. And if I'd carry a picture everywhere that I went, and I would take pictures of things that didn't really inspire me, and I had to learn to only take pictures in places where they inspire me. And even going out into the desert the last couple of days, there were a lot of places that I took pictures that didn't inspire me, because I was thinking, you've gone all of this way, and you need to do something to at least document this area.
Hmm.
But there just wasn't much happening that was speaking to me. And that was on, I went up to Roosevelt Lake and came back down in the Apache Trail from the other direction.
Okay.
And what I was looking for were crustates. But when I got along the Apache Lake, I just felt like there ought to be more inspiring photographs along here, and it just wasn't happening.
Hmm. How did the Sierra Club, how did you get in touch with them, and how did it work out that they sent you to Alaska? I missed that.
Well, when we were talking about my backpack trips earlier, I had, you know, totally not talked about the backpack trips that I had done into the superstitions, but I had this friend named Jerry Lobel, who was one of the trip leaders in the local Sierra Club. I think he might even have been an officer in the club. I didn't understand how it was structured.
V-O-G-L-E? Jerry?
L-O-B-E-L.
Sorry, spell it again.
L-O-B-E-L.
Lobel.
Jerry,
thank you.
Lobel.
Thank you.
And Jerry would lead trips, and he liked to take me along as an assistant leader and be his tail end Charlie. When you take 15 or 20 people in on a backpack, you needed somebody at the end to make sure you didn't have stragglers.
Got it.
That was always my job.
Okay.
But the problem was, every time that the line of people got strung out long enough that he would decide it was time to rest, he and the people in the front would set, and it'd be time to rest, and the rest of us would slowly catch up, and once those at the end who were really struggling caught up and sat down, it would only be a minute or two before he'd say, okay, we're back together again, let's get going, and those people wouldn't get to rest like the people
right
in the front did.
That's right.
I always thought that was kind of humorous.
Hmm.
But anyhow, we did several backpack trips into the superstitions on the main trails down there on the Peralta. We went into Weaver's Needle, took a trip once into a place called Robber's Roost. We went up the Siphon Draw Trail once, going up on top of the Flatiron. Did a backpack into it was Fish Creek, I think, that we went up into once. That was really terrible. It was so much boulder climbing. And then went into, in the Salt River Canyon, did a backpack into Cibicue Creek once, where the waterfalls are. And those were pretty special trips as far as backpacks. And those were all in the 1970s and maybe a couple into the early 80s, but I think, you know, by the 80s, my backpacking was pretty much done.
Okay.
But, oh, the point of that story was, though, the Sierra Club flew Jerry and I up to Alaska to take a group of people into the Alaska Range there to the southeast of Fairbanks to teach backpackers photography. And we set up a base camp, and then they would venture out onto, they did one overnight trip. I think they were going to do two overnight trips, but we had so much rain. We were in there, I think, for like, I'm thinking that we were in there for like 11 days, and it rained all but two of the days.
Oh, wow.
And it was really a wet trip. I mean, you know, they're in the base camp, and we spent most of our time in the tent. So, but it was eventful. But to get ready for that, I developed this series of lectures. I think there were six of them at the time that I was going to give to all of these people to improve their photography. And then later, I took those six lectures, and I expanded them into a workbook, because once I had retired, one of the things that I wanted to do was, I was looking, and this was right in the vicinity of 2000, I was putting these lectures together in a workbook that I went and had 1,000 printed in black and white, because my intention was to go into the resort hotels in the city of Phoenix where they were having conventions and offer up programs to give those lectures with a slideshow for the spouses of people that were attending, that brought their spouses with them who didn't have anything to do while they were attending whatever they were there for. I would do these shows for the spouses and show them places to go and how to do the photography. And this was long before people started doing these photographic workshops that are so popular now. And my intention wasn't to do a workshop out in the field. It was to show people some of the places they can go, and then to do these lectures on how to do the photographs and improve their photography.
Cool.
And then that series of lectures and the workbooks that I developed have become the subject matter that I have rewritten and done new photographs in one of the three books that I have in manuscript form right now that I'm not sure what to do with.
Okay.
That was a mouthful when all you asked me about was a cigar club trip to Alaska.
No, that's good. That's good.
There was a lady up there that wanted me to stay and get married.
Oh, really? In Alaska?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, if you could handle so many days of rain, I can see why you would have been attractive.
Well, you know, she was like a psychologist or a psychiatrist. I can't remember. And she owned this big, huge house up on the Steel Highway.
Oh, my gosh.
And she convinced me to stick around for an extra week.
Huh.
And so I stayed up there, and on about the second or third day, I asked her something to the effect of, what are we doing here? And she says, well, you seem like a man that I'm really interested in, so, you know, I would like to have plans for you. And I said, are you talking about marriage? And she says, well, yeah, I think so. And so I asked her right out, I said, well, you know, like, you see hardly anything up here but men. Why would you be interested in someone like me when there's so many people already up here available? And so she said, well, I need to send you back with something. And she took me to downtown Fairbanks into this store that had all these shirts and sweatshirts. And she bought me this shirt. And this shirt, on the top of it, it says 19-1. And she says, that's the number, the ratio of men to women here. And then below the 19-1, it says, the odds are good, but the goods are odd.
Ah, yes.
But as it turned out, I asked her about the winters. And, you know, when she's talking about how, you know, we watched the sunset out on the Steel Highway where the sun never did really go down. And she's telling me in the winter, it's the same thing where all you get is a little bit of twilight it never does get daytime. And then I ask her, well, how cold does it get? And she says, well, it's not uncommon for us to get to 40 below zero.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm set 40 below zero, and it's dark outside. What do you do getting to and from work? And she says, well, if you'll notice, all the parking lots have these heaters where you plug in a heated dipstick to put into your
tank
oil
heater.
Pan.
You bet.
So that you'll be able to start your car when you get out during the day.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, this place isn't for me.
I like Phoenix. It's very nice. Yeah, you come visit me in the winter.
Yeah, there's a reason I live in the desert. And as beautiful as Alaska is, I only want to see it in the summer, and even that's cold.
Yeah. Well, Richard, this sounds like maybe a nice place to wrap up this interview series. What do you think?
I think so. I'm not sure that I have anything else to offer you.
Well, this is lovely. That's what I wanted to hear, is that we haven't left too much out. I think that's good.
Yeah. I mean, I could tell you stories for days, but they aren't pertinent to what the interview is about.
Okay. Well, I think with that, then, we'll go ahead and conclude part 5. Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Richard Strange. Today is Saturday, February 25th, 2023. And Richard, thank you so very much for a wonderful series. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.